Be thankful
and
for
don't
the ups.
Think about the downs.
Yeah, and when you're in the downs, be patient. You're going to go up again eventually.
Yes,
right?
You're going to be out
but
of
we
it.
We don't practice that attitude we're supposed to have, you see?
Yes, exactly. Well, there's exactly where we're going for a little break. Hope you're not tired. Don't go anywhere. Stick to Youth Station. We'll be back as fast as the wind.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So welcome back to your own program, the most desired station in life, Youth Station. This is IRIB English Radio and Asma is talking to you. Here with us, we have Brother Muzaffar and we're discussing some very fascinating topics. We were talking about controlling things, coping with things, and not losing temper, which is a very difficult topic.
Mm-hmm. I actually had a question for you. So you went through that really difficult time.
Yes.
How did you get through it?
I just prayed a lot, and God is the only thing that you can clinch into. Mm-hmm. The only thing, the only thought that made me a little bit easier with the situation and alleviated me for a while was that God is watching us, and He, of course, would not leave the person who is lying on Him, who's leaning on Him, who's trusting Him, who would never let you down. That was the only thing that made me stick together and go on.
Mm-hmm. According to Shahid Dasghib, Ayatollah Dasghib,
yes,
in his book Greater Sins, I believe he lists after shirk. Shirk is the number one greatest sin, according
yes,
to him.
Yes, and then despair.
The second one is despair.
Yes.
Despair, not alcohol, not riba,
yes,
not
and God
to
has
haram
always
music.
Told us not to go into that phase when you are hopeless and you think there is no hope.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing that could ever happen to a person.
Yeah.
Because that's the easiest thing when it creeps in your thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is very much around you. It ambushes you wherever you are. It's the easiest one, the one who's always beside you. But you shouldn't give it like leaves and let it grow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You should just go for hope. Hope is the last thing that die.
See, this despair is actually kufr.
Exactly.
It's actually disbelief.
Yes.
And you might not openly announce or even to yourself announce that I no longer believe in God,
yes,
na'udhu billah,
yes,
or I no longer believe in the Quran, I no longer believe in the Prophet. You might not ever say that or ever think that.
Yes.
But you see, just like we're talking about different attitudes, there is an attitude of Islam, which is that attitude of thankfulness and patience.
Yes, true.
There's an attitude of kufr.
Yes.
And that attitude is despair. It is to kind of let go and be like, yeah, God is there, but He ain't going to help me.
May He forgive us.
May He forgive us, honestly, because we've actually committed that great sin.
Well, just like this, in a blink of an eye, we get to the tail end of another topic in Youth Station. Hope you all enjoyed it wholeheartedly. This was IRIB English Radio, and I was Asma with Brother Muzaffar. We were super pleased to be with you. Until another session of Youth Station, I ask Allah to keep you all safe and sound. May Allah be always on your side.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a new story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to commemorate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which culminated in the coming to power of the Islamic Republic in February 1979. And we're going to focus on the Islamic values that this revolution espoused, such as the necessity of governing Muslim societies by the laws of Allah and the need for Muslims worldwide to unite. But first, here's a report looking back at those momentous days in 1979.
On February 1st, 1979, millions of Iranians welcomed the return of their charismatic leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the imam who led a revolution which toppled an oppressive Western-backed regime and changed the course of history. Imam Khomeini's arrival to Tehran following 15 years in exile intensified months of popular protests against the Pahlavi regime. 10 days later, the rallies culminated in the downfall of the regime, ending the more than two millennia of monarchy in Iran. Imam Khomeini not only stood for Iranian self-determination, but pushed for Muslim unity, strength, and Islamic anti-imperialism, which the Muslim world had yet to see rise to a level which could effectively oust Western hegemony over Middle Eastern countries. The Islamic Revolution also established a new political system, a republic based on Islamic values and democracy. Since the revolution, the lives of Iranians have improved tremendously. Life expectancy has increased from 55 to 76%. Literacy rating risen from 47% to 96.6%, with a medical, sporting, and scientific ranking to rival the world's best, and a powerful military which assists the region's struggle against terrorism and colonialism. Imam Khomeini's revolution proved that Muslims can win against the odds, and Islam can work in a modern political setting.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Iran's revolution and its Islamic significance, I have Masoud Shajareh, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission here in London, and also Sister Batul Subaiti, who is a political activist and commentator. Welcome to the show. Thank you both very much for coming on. Now, Masoud, I want to come straight to you because I was surprised to learn you appeared like a young man to me, but you apparently were around during that time, and you may have some memories of the revolution, which I don't have, for example. Could you just tell us, what was it like to go through that period, the real revolutionary decade after the revolution took place?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I think it's very important to realize what was the environment just before the revolution in Iran, and indeed globally. Islam wasn't recognized as relevant to that time's people's political, social, economical sort of needs. It was seen as a fuddy-duddy sort of Eastern religion, which was something of the past and no relevant to the present. And that's on one side. And the other side, Iran was going through huge sort of difficulties, you know, the dictatorship of Shah, and the fact that economically, politically, Iran was really bottom, and you know, the Shah was number one sort of agent and servant of the West, but it wasn't actually able to do anything for the ordinary Iranian people. There was such an unhappiness within Iran. And I remember going to Iran just a couple of years before. And when I came back, I was talking to everyone and saying, look, it's not going to go on like this. There's going to be a change. I didn't expect it to be so soon, but it was obvious that the situation in Iran cannot continue like that. You know, the poverty, the injustice, everything was so ripe. But what happened with the revolution was Ayatollah Khomeini brought the spirit of Islam as a revival, as a tsunami, not just for Iran, but the whole world. You know, even in South America, who weren't really followers of Islam by any definition, they were inspired by the revolution of Iran because it stood against the number one stooge of the United States, which was abusing its own people for the benefit of the that colonial power. And I think that was something which then, it was a tsunami. It affected the Palestinian movement. It affected the Islamic movement around the world. Mm. Islam was seen as a revival tool, an empowering tool, which could actually undermine the tyranny of the time.
Yes, we are going to speak more about the sort of ripple effect the revolution had on the region, how it's helped other countries, other peoples as well. But Batul, I want to bring you in on this as well, because you perhaps represent a younger generation, of course, who perhaps look to the revolution still. Just tell me, what does the revolution mean to you, and what does it represent for you today?
Ultimately, to me, it represents dignity. It's a manifestation of the ayah from the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahim, kam min fa'atin qalilatin ghalabat fa'atin kathiratin bi'idhnillah. So how many times have an entity that's small in number and, let's say, a material strength has overcome an entity that's much larger in number and material strength by the way of God? So, of course, Islam is the determining factor, and it's the true identity for the people and for the society of Iran, which I think is something that really makes it stand out, is that Islam is not being used as a cover for the interests of those in power. In actual fact, Iran has had to basically let go of many short-term, you know, benefits or interests in pursuit of those higher objectives and in pursuit of those principles. And I see that Iran today in the region is probably the only country that's really standing as an obstacle to the Western imperialist project and has demonstrated that full hand. Not only is Iran stable today, but it's looking to create a new world order, one that that constitutes of respect, cooperation, growth, expertise. And look, it's been over four decades since the advent of the revolution. Its ideals are still very much within the hearts and minds of the Iranians, and I would say beyond. And I would say that for the younger generation, there's actually overpowering feelings. And we have to understand that this younger generation hasn't actually witnessed the revolution firsthand. It hasn't even witnessed the eight-year war. But look at the way that they, for example, commemorate their martyrs. You know, look at the way that today they commemorate the likes of Haj Qasem Soleimani. And this is all despite the soft war efforts to basically weaken and to target their faith. So we have to put it within that context. So I think that shows that the revolution has a dynamic understanding of the needs of the younger generation that are inherently attracted to it.
And of course, I think it's worth mentioning that Iran right now is facing a kind of Western pressure campaign. Mm-hmm. And in specific, they're focusing on things like the woman's rights in Iran. Yeah. Tell me, do you think that the Islamic revolution has compromised on women's rights in Iran, or perhaps has empowered it, surprisingly, in another way?
I think the Islamic revolution has actually taken away those factors that would otherwise abuse a woman, essentially. I mean, if you look at the West, for example, you see that a woman is viewed as both a consumer and a merchandise. She's viewed as a product that buys and sells, and her worth is only seen insofar as she generates capital and revenue. Whereas you see that actually one of the core moral values and structures is to focus on the family institution, strengthening the family institution. The role of a mother, for example, that she plays in terms of nurturing the future generations, that's something that's very much focused upon, and the value of a woman inherently and instinctively, as well as her participation in wider society. We see that, for example, the hijab is seen as an essential component to strengthen the family institution and to also facilitate the role of a woman in wider society. Imam Khomeini, you know, very famously, when he was speaking to a group of men, he told them, you know, do you think it is your speeches that have brought down the Shah? It is these very women. Treat them with honor. What he was saying was that these women were leading at the forefront of the protest movements. They were disseminating the education. They were disseminating the information within wider society. The only caveat that I would say was placed was that the hijab is the means and is the vehicle through which a woman can interact in society to maximize that productivity and that effort. So I would say actually the obstacles that would take away a woman's productivity and potential have been removed, and actually she's been respected and honored for the output that she gives to society, as well as her innate role that she plays as a mother and as a wife.
Well, that's really insightful. Thank you so much for sharing. And Masood, I want to ask you about the work that you've done here in the UK. It's been very much focused on, you know, bringing Sunnis and Shias and different Muslims from different backgrounds together to kind of achieve a joint objective towards empowering Muslims and so on. But that's also something which the Islamic Revolution has tried to achieve on a bigger regional level. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Revolution was a reflection of what the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. So when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, At-tasmu bihamdillahi jami'an, and orders you to come together, any Islamic movement has to put that as one of its sort of aims and objectives. You know, Islamic movements, so-called, who think they could go by creating fractions and grouping and, you know, theological sort of basis and ignore everyone else, it's going against that verses of Quran, and indeed against the concept of Islam. To unite, I mean, look, every Muslim and non-Muslim knows that for us to achieve our aspirations as Muslims, we need to unite. We need to come together for those issues. And indeed, we need to even unite with others other than Muslim for those issues. To be involved in sort of sectarianism and so forth, it actually is counterproductive to that. So it was absolutely essential for the Islamic movement and the Islamic revolution to have that as one of his aims and objectives. And I think that's essential for any Islamic movement.
Yes, of course, sectarianism is a poison which has plagued the region for far too long. And it's great to see Absolutely. That there is a nation, the Islamic Republic, in the Middle East, which is fighting against that. However, before we continue this discussion, I want to bring in and remind ourselves of a particular Quranic verse, which is often associated with the Islamic Revolution. The verse in the fifth surah of the Quran tells us that Allah will always replace those who turn away from Him with people who are better and who will strive in the path of God, no matter how the disbelievers dislike it. Well, let's come back to the discussion now. Batul, I want to come back to you on this, because one thing which Iran has done very, very well since 1979 until now, which doesn't get nearly enough coverage, particularly in Western mainstream circles, is the effort that they've done to combat extremism, combat terrorism. In fact, Iran has played a huge role in defeating notorious terrorist groups like Daesh, for example, in Iraq. Perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us.
Absolutely. I think at the crux of it, Iran has an open hand policy. So that is every oppressed individuals, no matter what their background is, no matter what their religion is, no matter what system of governance they have in place, they will unite on the basis of causes and on the basis of those inherent values. So we see that, for example, when Iran had to fight, because Iraq had invaded essentially during the Iran-Iraq war, that did not stop it. The fact that the whole world was, you know, besieging and sanctioning Iran and all kinds of weapons and ammunitions were used against them, still then, when they were at their lowest point in terms of material strength, did they still reach their hands out to the Palestinians to support them, essentially, in their fight against the occupation? It did the same thing in Lebanon. You know, Iran was crucial in the formation of Hezbollah and in their support, this Lebanese liberation group, which essentially defeated Israel in 2000 and drove them out. And Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the individuals who is hailed as having a key role to play, essentially, in the imparting of the strategic, basically, advice and training that he had had. So ultimately, what it is that Iran has a vision. And that vision is that wherever there is oppression, that oppression needs to be uprooted. And that oppression is uprooted by giving the necessary support to those individuals on the ground and training them such that they can become self-sufficient to fight that enemy. You know, the overcoming of the enemy won't happen unless the individuals themselves on the ground want that to happen. So, for example, we see that even within the Palestinian liberation groups, they would train them how to create bullets, for example. They would train them how to create these tunnels. Rather than making them kind of dependent, they would seek to make them self-sufficient. And it sees the struggle as one united struggle against a greater enemy. So it's like Imam Khomeini defined America as the great Satan. So anyone that wants to support in weakening the hegemony of America, we will support in that pursuit. We will unite for that objective. essentially.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how nowadays you find that Iran has a relationship with many countries around the world who are not Muslim majority. Venezuela, for example, Iran has played a role in helping them. So, Masood, I'm going to come back to you because it seems to me as if you look at how Iran is now to how it was back before 1979, the misconception is that Islam removes human rights, that Islam is anti-education for women, that type of thing. But actually, surprisingly, women education is at an all-time high in Iran. Literacy level has improved since the revolution, that type of thing. And now Iran is a world competitor in the field of sciences, sport, and so on. So perhaps you could elaborate on that point as well for us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what the sister said regarding the saying of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, that women were instrumental in bringing the revolution. They were also the actual beneficiaries. They benefited a lot more than the men in as a result of the revolution. The number of sort of women at universities, the number of judges, the number of the lecturers and professors, and politicians, it really is not possible to compare it with Shah's time. You know, at the Shah's time, the freedom for the women was dependent on the inches of the skirts. You know, the higher it went, you know, there were more freedom. Well, here you could actually measure it by empowerment of women to take their rightful place. But also, I think Iran, although was the number one importer and buying weapons from United States, when the war took place, Iran was not capable, didn't have the resources, except the manpower and the dedication of the Mujahideen to actually defend itself. Now Iran is a regional power. And when you look at all the other technology, you see that Iran is number five, number four, number seven in the world, despite all the sanctions and everything. I think what is really important is that we need to ask the question, why is it Iran being singled out with this sort of attack by global sort of West day in, day out? Is it really anything to do with the human right, for example? You know, when we see the Saudis have actually given death penalty for someone for tweeting, and the world is completely silent, and then in Iran, someone gets death penalty for killing people in the demonstration in front of the international community and on the cameras, then there is a huge opposition. So we need to actually be able to have a filter to understand that, you know, what is going on. There are at the moment 127 channels beaming sort of Farsi into Iran. I mean, this is not economical. This has all been fabricated. This has all been organized. This is really a tool of trying to undermine a country which is not just standing for is independent, but also is the aid for all others, including Venezuela, including South America and elsewhere.
You've mentioned, of course, a kind of criticism campaign against the Islamic Republic that does exist. Criticism ranges from things like they claim it's a dictatorship, they claim that, you know, Iran is being expansionist and is trying to pursue some kind of Persian Empire building project in the Arab world, that type of thing. How would you respond to this type of criticism? What would you say about it?
You know, I mean, look at forget the spins. Look at the reality. Look at the statistic. Look at the history. Iran hasn't invaded any country, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, Iran has actually, as the sister said, helped and support others to be able to empower themselves against one of the greatest atrocities against them, like the Palestinians, like the Lebanese, like Venezuela. You know, it really is not there to sort of colonize everywhere else. It's there to help and support, despite the fact that itself is under huge pressure, a pressure sanctions.
But Saul, I want to bring you in because we haven't got a lot of time left before the end of the show. Again, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the criticism. Other criticisms include, for example, that it's a revolution for Shia Muslims. You know, this is a Shia Muslim majority country. It's ultimately for them only. That's their main interest. How would you respond to that?
I just want to respond to the thing before that, and that is on the point of dictatorship. And it is that Iran is a very active and energetic nation. So in 1979, the whole world was seeking to crush this revolution. That was the whole point of the eight-year war. That's the whole point of the economic sanctions that we're seeing today, that Iran has turned from a challenge to an opportunity. So essentially, for someone to come and to say that it's a dictatorship, okay, Iran right now is being sanctioned for this revolution. Who is maintaining this revolution? What is its support base? Its support base is the people, because where else is it going to get that support? It doesn't have any kind of foreign support. And if you look at the inherent institutions within Iran, they're in such a way that they rest on the people. They're made up of the masses of the people, and they're designed to monitor each other. For example, just take the IRGC, the besiege, for instance, these different institutions. So if today, if really and truly the Iranian nation today did not want an Islamic Republic, and the world is telling Iran that if you get rid of this Islamic Republic, we will remove these sanctions away from you, it doesn't make sense to say that the people in Iran actually are not happy and want to remove the system. Yes, they have their criticisms. Of course, they have their criticisms like in any other country. But what actually the people in Iran are asking for is for the government to get closer to the Islamic ideals. It's to get closer to the models. They have a problem with the reformist ideologies that is, you know, bringing about more of a neoliberal model. That's the kind of internal critique. A lot of internal criticism happens not to remove the Islamic component. It's like, oh, this revolution is meant to be based on full social justice. So we want to see more of that being enacted within internal policies. And of course, Iranians are very, very smart and politically aware and read. So they're aware of what the external reality is like. They're aware of the machinations of the enemy, essentially. And in terms of this question about it being, you know, Shias, I think, like Brother Masoud was saying, reality speaks for itself. If Imam Khomeini went out of his way to cut ties with South Africa because of the apartheid, if Iran goes out of its way to be the only entity to ship oil and fuel to Venezuela that's under the same sanctions for the same pretext that Iran is in, and that is because it's trying to carve out its own trajectory and its own line, if Iran goes out of its way to support the Palestinian Liberation Group like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Haj Qasem Soleimani even himself stressed that we don't give weapons and support on the basis of whether you are Sunni, whether you are Shia, what your background is. You either surrender to the enemy or you face the enemy. That is ultimately what determines whether we will be supporting you or it's futile, essentially.
Unfortunately, Batul, we are out of time, but I think you've summarised your point very, very effectively. And to you, Sir Masoud, thank you to you both for joining me, and thank you for everyone at home for tuning in as well. But don't worry, next week we'll be back for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Salaamu Alaikum.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Shortage of electricity in the UK has forced utilities to pay people to turn off lights. There are reports that more than a million households in England, Scotland and Wales will be paid to cut back their electricity usage between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. to prevent blackouts. It comes amid warnings that energy supplies will be tighter than normal on one of the coldest days of the year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Guardian, households and businesses in Britain will be paid to cut back on their electricity use between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. in the first real test of a national grid scheme. With temperatures dropping sharply, the electricity system operator hopes to reduce the strain on the grid by reducing consumption. The initiative, which has only been used as a test up to now, will take place during the early evening peak in Britain's energy demand. Through the smart meter, energy firms monitor usage every 30 minutes. Companies will give households 24 hours notice that a saving session is upcoming, and it will require customers to reduce their consumption by at least 30%. The greater the reduction, the greater the discount, which is automatically applied to the bill. Guardian also noted consumers are likely to use various methods to save power during the period, including making sure none of their devices are charging or pushing back meal times. A household's power use will be compared with their normal usage for that time of day, and they will receive about £3 for every kilowatt hour saved. Also, the website of RT wrote in this regard, more than a million UK homes and businesses are set to be paid to use less energy between 5 and 6 p.m. local time as part of the National Grid's Demand Flexibility Service aimed at preventing blackouts during periods of high usage. Customers with any of 26 UK energy suppliers can receive a small sum for cutting their usage below average levels during the one-hour period. National Grid announced recently, warning the country was facing tighter than normal supply margins. It is the first time the scheme has been implemented since it was announced last year, aside from tests. The amount received varies depending on how much the customer is able to cut back their usual usage. With about £3 doled out for every kilowatt hour saved, estimated payouts run between £6 and £20. In case additional power is needed, three coal-fired power plants that were set to be retired in September amid the UK's green energy transformation have been placed on standby. National Grid revealed recently, however, the utility stressed that customers should not worry, insisting it was only implementing DFS and tapping the coal plants as precautionary measures to maintain the buffer of spare capacity they need. National Grid has previously warned that rolling three-hour blackouts may be possible during January and February in case of energy shortages. The UK imports about half of its energy and costs have skyrocketed as Western sanctions on Russia severely limited the available supply for participating countries. Critics have dismissed DFS, arguing it requires too much work for minimal savings. Others see it as an unfair penalty levied against those without smart meters installed, as only those customers whose homes or businesses are equipped with the controversial devices can participate. However, project head Craig Dyke has big plans, declaring DFS will drive forward towards net zero and calling it the start of something much, much bigger. Meanwhile, local news websites have reported that homes across Sussex are still without power after outages on Sunday morning, January 22nd. While plenty of homes have been restored, hundreds still remain unconnected due to the power outages. Homes in Eastbourne, Seaford and Willingdon are still affected. Engineers from UK Power Networks, UKPN, have said they are working to fix the issue, and it was initially hoped that all homes would have power returned by 7:30 p.m. on January 26th. UKPN has said the outages in Eastbourne were caused by an underground electricity cable has faulted on high-voltage network, causing an area-wide power cut. Meanwhile, the outage in Seaford has been put down a faulty piece of equipment which controls the power to the homes.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. And in this program, we try to answer your questions, queries, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University, Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
Well, Professor, since you have been helping us with so many audience questions about adolescence, we have a question about a child. The age is not mentioned, but the mother says that my child, whatever he wants, he is very pressurizing us so that he reaches his goal, whatever he wants. How do I deal with this child? The mother has not mentioned the age of a child, but she's concerned about the fact that a child is putting pressure to get whatever he wants. So how does a mother deal with this child?
I think that one thing which we all need to learn and make our children learn is to say no in a proper way. Many of us feel that we can't say no to anyone.
Okay.
Sometimes there are things which are more important, sometimes things are less, not that important. We cannot sacrifice important things
For unimportant things.
For unimportant things. But unfortunately, we are prone to do such things. We, for example, if someone asks us for a favor, though taking care of others' needs is a very important thing in Islam, there's no doubt about it. But unfortunately, generally speaking, maybe you can deflect that thing which is being asked of you in such a way that the other person does not feel bad about it. Or saying no becomes easier than saying yes when you're not able to deliver. If you say no in the beginning and you can't, if you say no, it's much better than saying yes and not being able to take
carry out that.
So we, unfortunately, we all of us, most of us, many of us, are not good at saying no. And that happens especially to our with respect
parents.
To our children, the parents who are dealing with their children. Now the children, they see they want something, they start crying. If you don't give them something they want, they start crying. At the tender age,
at a very early age.
They start becoming irritated, screaming, whatever. Now if you, that's the pressure being applied by the child. If you are able to control that situation and you're able to fight off that and you are able to deflect his state, the urgency of that matter is, you know, changed, and the child is made to realize that yes, he will get what he wants,
but not on crying,
not by crying, not by making us irritated. It should not become a behavior.
One thing that you're trying to say over here is that if a child starts crying and we abruptly carry out the things that he wants, is a wrong thing that we
exactly.
are doing.
Number one, if he, for example, the parents, before he wants something, give things to him or her in a way that he finds out that if I want to gain something, it has to be as a result of something which I must be doing.
Okay.
If there's a certain understanding which is developed, and everyone knows in the family that, look, if we want to go out and watch TV or we want to go for a picnic, then we must take care of certain things. We may take care of, we should be putting our clothes in the proper place. For example, children, when they're elder and old enough to be taking care of their own stuff.
Yeah.
So everyone knows there are certain rules. If we follow these rules, some reward will follow automatically. So in the form of good food, in the form of an outing, in the form of a film watching. We're going to watch a film together. The family together is going to watch a film. That's something as a reward, a good film maybe.
Yeah.
So everyone knows that if everyone is taking care of the chores that are there, studies, whatever, then everything will fall in place. So there's a set of rule which applies to everyone.
Yeah, Professor, we'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakawi, and you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. We're discussing about a child who either cries or does many other things just to reach his goal. The first thing, Professor, you made clear over here is that if a child starts crying just to reach something, we definitely do not have to give him the particular thing on his crying, because that way a child feels that whenever I want to get something, I just have to cry and the things will be at my excess. Number two, you said that parents have to learn speaking no. And speaking no is sometimes better rather than saying yes and when you are unable to deliver. And you also said, we got to increase the leisure time.
We need to, not just the leisure time. I mean, for example, a child wants something in the form of maybe he or she says, I want to eat something. I want to eat a toffee, a chocolate. I want a chocolate. So he or she knows that if I want to get this favor, I need to do something. Then he or...
So there should be some rules.
Rules. And secondly, the important thing is when I accept upon his crying or screaming or whatever, he or she understands.
I'm actually giving a weak nerve in his hands.
Exactly. It's either because I don't want to get annoyed and irritated by the screaming, so I want to give the things immediately.
But sometimes mothers especially are emotional. So
there are two reasons. Basically, they can't bear their child crying. They are so soft-hearted. They're so in such a way that they can't bear the child
to be crying
and screaming. Or they can't bear him. They get annoyed. So they want to give the thing out quickly so he stops crying. So in both cases, we need to be strong. We need to be firm. And we need to make a decision, make the child realize that this will be, I will give it to you, but please sit down, stop crying, you will get it.
Yeah.
So we need to be firm, we need to be loving.
We have to rather make him understand the rules. So rule to get this thing is this thing.
Sit down, stop crying, maybe behave yourself properly, and then I will give it to you. But not, as you said, spontaneously. You see, the moment he starts yelling... And you give the thing out to him. That's
not the wrong thing. All right. So the thing that we get over here is that giving things on just crying or on just any other behavior of a child is a wrong thing. What is important is that you have to just give him the thing, but after the following the rules. Tell him, all right, if you want to reach this particular goal or if you need this particular thing, you got to follow this guideline so that you get your reward.
And if you don't do that, today he's screaming or she's screaming.
Tomorrow he will bang his head.
He will bang his head or he will start breaking things. Then there's no end to it, you know.
Okay, the things will start getting worse if you do that. So stop being emotional fools, mothers. Yes, women are soft-hearted, but they need to control. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, be inviters to people by means other than your tongue.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi helped us with so many questions over here. The thing that we have been talking about is that if a child pressurizes a mother or a father for a particular thing, you don't have to give him things on that pressure. You have to start learning speaking no to the child, and you have to have some certain kind of rules. If you want a particular thing, you got to follow a particular path. Well, Professor,
I must add, you should stop pampering your children. Sometimes they don't want things themselves. You start giving them things too much without any rules, without any specific understanding or a specific procedure or behavior which has to be done. You just pamper them. You just want to give them so many things. You feel that you can...
Just giving is parenting.
Is parenting. Giving whatever they want and whatever they like and make them...
Whatever they even don't want.
So that's worse than that.
Okay. So here the things go wrong. When we are giving, we are pampering things they want and things they do not want, just thinking that this is parenting, while you say this is not parenting, we gotta educate ourselves because parenting is really a difficult job. Well, there's one more question which says that how do I teach my child to accept failure in his life? It's a parent question. And how does a mother or a father help his child accept failures?
We need to understand, we need to make ourselves and our children realize that every failure can lead to success. failure is not something one is
end doomed. Of life.
It's not the end of the day. It's not the end of life. A failure, if one does not fail, one does not succeed. Success comes from failure. One is able to struggle failure after failure. Even then, if he continues to struggle properly, he will achieve success eventually. So this is important. Failures are for the sake of learning. And what is failure? What does failure mean, actually? Does it mean that what we went out to find, we did not get it? We may have found something better. The Holy Quran says, there are many things that you like, but they may be bad for you.
Harmful
for you. Sharful lakum. They may be evil for you. And there are many things which you feel they're not. You don't like them. But maybe there's a lot of benefits.
Goodness in it.
So basically, we need to understand that we need to be content with life. We need to be content with our failures. We need to be content with our successes. Number one, we should understand what is failure and what
we
is.
We have to change the definition of failure in our home.
Exactly. Our attitude towards failure, towards events of life, have to change. Failure is not necessarily losing something. Failure should, even losing something, maybe. God promises in the Holy Quran that if I take away one ni'mah, I give you 10
others, alternatives.
So what is the definition of failure? And success has to be understood. And even if it is true failure, even then we need to be able to bear that. We need to be able to analyze that, and we need to be able to come up with alternatives. Alternative paths to success. We must learn from our failures, and we must realize that this world is a continuous struggle, and the true success is happiness with Allah Almighty and His happiness with us. We need to be pleased and content, and we need to thank Him for what we have. We should be content, and we should be thankful and praiseworthy. We should praise Him because of what we have. And if we lose something, we also should be patient and should be thankful for Him in all cases. So we need to be to develop that feeling of satisfaction, this contention with Allah's will, what He wills for us. And if we have made a mistake, then it should be because we should realize that we have reached this failure because of our mistakes.
All right. So the definition of failure has to be changed in the home. The environment has to be changed. And you got to teach your child that failures are pillars to success. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to your listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. We'll be there. And in case you want to listen to our program or our previous sessions as well, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/encoicallofislamtab. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.